Yeah, I can probably begin now, because this is the last formal talk of this 9-day retreat, which started only a moment ago and hasn't finished yet. There's still a few moments to go, but there's always a time when you have to give the last formal talk. And it's great to be able to talk with you at the interviews to see how the retreat was going and to see some smiley faces last night after the question time when I came in from Donamala. And I think we should do that every retreat, I think. Whoever's teaching the retreat, whether it's myself, Sister Wayama, or whatever, we should say the last day we go back to our rooms just to have an easy time. But then we sneak up and listen and have a good laugh. Because it's important, I hope you understand from the events of this retreat, that meditation is not a very dull and hard, boring path. It's very often full of fun and light-heartedness. Because the light-heartedness is a sign that the mind is becoming free. Free from the heavy weights which we tend to carry around with us all the time. And I was very, very happy, almost like relieved, when I first went to places like Thailand to see all these great Thai forest monks having such a great sense of humour and being so light-hearted and full of fun. Because it gave me the understanding that the path to enlightenment is not a sort of a sour-faced, dull, depressing path. It's a very, very light-hearted and peaceful path. And that gave me a lot of confidence that when I read things in the suttas, such as one of my favourite quotes, the Dhammacaya Sutta, where King Pasenadri, going to the Jeta Grove, said how often he loved going to that monastery, because all the monks were always smiling and happy. And the Buddha replied, yes, great king, that's what you can expect when people practice the meditation and they get stages of enlightenment. They get happy and smiling. So hopefully that during this retreat you've understood that those moments of cracking jokes, of laughing, are not somehow apart from the path. They're not so separate from what we're doing here, but they're all part of the gradual process to awakening. And as such, it means that you come on a retreat and you don't need to dread 9 days of solid meditation and being serious. Instead, the retreat becomes something you look forward to, something the mind enjoys, both the quiet and deep meditations, but also the joyful part of the retreat, the light-heartedness. Because, quite frankly, that the monks I grew up with, the ones who are the serious ones, the ones who are the gung-ho ones, the ones who would sit and just be so sour-faced, were always the ones who disrobed. And they left, but it was the happy ones. And the ones who were light-hearted, were easy to please, contented and easily satisfied, not demanding in nature, not conceited or proud, like we say every morning. Those were the ones, sort of, who stayed. And when you got to know them afterwards, were obviously developing very, very deep and powerful states of meditation and insight. So it's a wonderful thing to know that the joy of a retreat is part of it. Which is why that sometimes I tell monks who are on retreat, or especially during the 3-month range retreat we have at places like Bodhinyana, there are times for what we call playtime. And playtime is a time when you allow the mind just to sort of enjoy so the fruits of its peace and its meditation. I always remember this story of a monk who was sitting under a tree and he was chanting these words, Aho Sukhang, Aho Sukhang, Aho Sukhang, which means, oh what bliss, oh what bliss, oh what bliss. When the monks saw him, they thought, that guy's indulging in something. Is he thinking sexual fantasies? Or has he just had a really nice meal? What's he up to? Because they thought the monk should be so serious. And then when he went to see the Buddha said, no, that monk has been understanding some Dhamma and has appreciated his freedom. And that's why he's enjoying the bliss of such freedom. Aho Sukhang, oh what bliss, oh what bliss, oh what bliss. And there does come times in your meditation when you're sitting there, and if you could say anything, that's what you should say. Oh, what bliss! Aho sukhan, aho sukhan, aho sukhan. Oh, what bliss! Which shows you that this path is like a happy path, is a peaceful path, is a joyful path. If nirvana, enlightenment, is supposed to be the ultimate happiness, and it's supposed to be a gradual path, then you'd expect that as the path progresses, it gets happier and happier and happier. And indeed, one of the fundamental sutras, actually, which contains the part which is repeated in about 30 or 40 sutras in the canon of Buddhism, it first comes up in what's called the Samanyapada Sutra, number 2 in the Digha Nikaya, called the Fruits of the Holy Life. And that particular story was when King Ajatasattu, who had just taken over from King Sainya Bimbisara of Magadha, and he went to go and see the Buddha for the first time in a bamboo grove. And when he was being led there by his doctor, Jivaka, it was so quiet and silent, he was afraid that somehow that there was a trap for him, because kings are always afraid of being attacked. But the doctor said, no, it's just a quiet place. That's why there's no sound, even though there's hundreds of monks here. And he went into the hall where the monks were meditating, sitting so quietly. And number one, King Ajatasattu had to ask, which one is the Buddha? Because they all looked alike. I know that sometimes people say, and according to our iconography, the Buddha was somehow taller, or had these bulbs on top of his head, or long ears, or something you could distinguish him by. But if that was the case, that would make no sense of this sutta where Ajatasattu could not recognize amongst all the other monks which one was the Buddha, and had to be pointed out, the one over there sitting in the middle against the middle pillar. But also, he turned around, he said, oh, if only my son could enjoy such peace as these monks. It was such a quiet and inspiring thing for a king to see. But then, when he announced himself and had a discussion with the king actually asked a question which you may have asked last night. Why did you become a monk? What's the point of this? And the king replied, and the Buddha replied, for happiness. How can you be happy, you know, just eating sort of alms food, and not having wives, and not having cooks, and menus, and all these other pleasures which I as a king enjoy? And the Buddha replied, can you, great king, just enjoy 7 days of uninterrupted pleasure? The king said, no, of course not. And he said, I can. Who knows, maybe one of you. Some of you may have enjoyed 9 days of uninterrupted pleasure. But certainly, you get some happiness, and that happiness is huge. And the Buddha said, yeah, the happiness of this path is much greater than the happiness of a great king. And then he started to describe for the first time what he called a gradual process to enlightenment, which wasn't getting wiser and wiser, but getting happier and happier. It's a wonderful thing to describe this whole path of enlightenment as a gradual path of increasing and deepening happiness. And he's saying that just when you start to practice virtue, just keeping precepts, not because you have to, because you want to, because you see the benefit in them. And the precepts make you happier beings. It's as if, like, the sea or the ocean, sure it has waves on it and has its peaks and its troughs, but as the tide rises, or as we get global warming and the sea levels rise, so does the average level of happiness, the average level of that sea. And it's the case that as a person keeps a virtue, sure they have their highs and lows in life, but the average level of their happiness gets higher and higher and higher. You literally become happier people. He said that's the first fruits of this practice, a happiness due from virtue. And he said further, you start to simplify your life. And especially for a monk, we live very, very simply. He called it sense restraint. And on this retreat you've had a lot of sense restraint. Haven't been watching movies or TVs. You've just been, maybe your only pleasure has been playing with that Willy Wagtail outside, the friendly one. Now what a wonderful joy that has been. And sometimes actually people go and watch the Nature Channel to see something like that, but you've actually been starving on the Nature Channel. You've been there enjoying it instead of looking at it as a picture on a box. And you get so much happiness out of that, just living a simple 9 days. And the Buddha said that's the next level of happiness, just from sense restraint. But then he went higher and said that then you get into these meditation states, and everyone is higher and happier than the next. And many of you have realized that. Some of you have had the happiest experience you've ever had. Some of you have already got the peaceful happinesses. And it's just so nice just sitting here and having nothing to worry about, making peace with things and being happy. And you go higher, and when you get into the jhanas, your happiness goes into other levels. And he said the happiness of those jhanas, as I said before, are just so amazing and so blissful and so pure. You're getting to a happiness which most people in the world don't understand, they can never touch. But it's a gradual increase of happiness. Some of you during this retreat have got those nimittas coming up, and sometimes the first time those nimittas come up, they're so powerful and so beautiful you want to cry, which is quite natural. I remember one of the first deep experiences which I had of meditation. Just afterwards, the layman who taught me that method, I just wanted to stop myself from grabbing his feet and kissing them. Even though I was a student, a man, just that's what you felt like. Someone has given you such amazing happiness, or at least helped you. And those are the natural feelings you have when you get so high and so happy. And it is a path of ever increasing happiness. It's a gradual path to enlightenment. So whenever you get any joy coming up from this path, now a joy which is born of what we say letting go, of simplifying, then that sort of joy and happiness should never be sort of thought little of. It should never be abandoned. You should never give it up. You should never be afraid of it. Because sometimes you hear some teachers saying, and I'm embarrassed that they say these things because they're completely against what the Buddha taught. They say, oh, if you start getting happy in meditation, throw it away, you get attached to it. And that's completely against the path which the Buddha taught. The Buddha said you should distinguish the different happinesses in this world. There are some happinesses which you should detach from because they're very sticky. There's other happinesses, and these are the happinesses of the mind, the happinesses born of letting go, which you should never be afraid of, which you should indulge in, make much of, and enjoy to the max. Of course, those are the pleasures of keeping precepts, the pleasures of inspiration. When you hear a great talk or you see a wonderful example of compassion and generosity and kindness, it's the feelings of joy. Now, when you start appreciating some of the Dhamma, it's the joy of doing a compassionate act for somebody else. It's the joy of letting go in meditation and finding peace in the heart. All of those joys which are founded on letting go, they're the ones you should indulge in and attach to and make much of. So in this retreat, hopefully you have experienced some of that inner joy. And if you have, well done. Never be afraid of that, because that's a sign that you are progressing on the path. As I think I said at the beginning of this retreat, you can tell a person's progress in meditation by the shape of their mouth. If the corners are turned down, they haven't had a good retreat. If their mouth is level, they still haven't had a good retreat. But if the corners are turned up, if they can laugh and smile easily, then their retreat has been a good one. They've got natural happiness. Just like the Buddha said, if you meditate properly, you can expect to be happy. So understanding the path of happiness is part of this path of meditation. You can also appreciate why I've taught this retreat in the way I have. That why the first few days you were encouraged to sleep and to rest and to give a sense of peace and ease to your body. And always remember that is an essential practice of this path. I know again other teachers might say, don't indulge your body, get up at 4 and get up here straight away and sit for 1 hour without moving. In some traditions, they go around with a stick, and anyone who's bending over gets whacked. I went to a monastery like that, just for a weekend retreat when I was a student. And I remember clearly on a Saturday morning, before dawn, being in the line, and just, you know, I was feeling sleepy, but I had lots of good calm. I was very lucky, because a fellow sitting next to me was more sleepy than I was. So he got hit first. The teacher said it's not supposed to hurt, but when I heard that whack, I didn't believe him. It was amazing. I never needed to get hit, just the guy next to me, and all my sloth and torpor completely disappeared. I bet you're right. They're not out of fear. It was fear and control, and of course my back was very straight, just out of fear of being hit. And it was not peaceful at all. It was terror. And that is not the way to meditate, about being terrified. Which is why, against that tradition, I always remember reading widely in Buddhism, and it's this great story of Lin Shi, or what we know as Rinzai. And Rinzai became one of the two great Zen, originators of one of the two great Zen lineages. You know, Soto Zen was basically started by Dogen, and Rinzai by Lin Shi. And in this story, again, it was the Rinzai tradition which used the stick a lot. In this tradition, in the early morning, Lin Shi was meditating in the Zendo, hunched over, with his head almost touching the floor. Then a master came in, a fierce master. And out of compassion, the monk sitting next to him elbowed him. "Master's come, get up quick." And Lin Shi, he didn't raise his head, still half on the floor. He just opened one eye, not two, he was very lazy, one eye. Looked at the master and said, "Oh, it's only him," and carried on dozing. At which the master exploded. "You monks, you terrible monks, there's only one real monk in this monastery, and that's Rinzai. He's letting go. All you other ones, control freaks, you don't know the first thing about meditation." And he scolded all the monks and praised Lin Shi, who became this great Zen master. And of course, when I first thought that, I first read that, and again, you can't really understand it. You think it's just like a weird, strange saying, and that Zen monks and Zen masters acting weirdly, as is their tradition. But when I examined it in more detail later on, you can see that all the other monks were just control freaks. And Lin Shi was letting go. He was resting because he was tired. And that's such an important thing for each one of you to learn. If you control your meditation and force it, you put it back a long time, you stress the mind, you do violence and injury to your mind. It's not the path. So what I taught in the first 2 days, or 3 days of resting, is essential to the path. It's not indulging you. It's learning how to be kind to your body. Once you learn how to be kind to your body, then maybe you can learn how to be kind to your mind, which is really what meditation is all about. Learn to be so kind to this mind of yours that you give it some peace and some rest. We work it too hard, which is why we get stressed and suffer. And instead, in meditation, we are not just give our body a break, we give our mind a rest. Always travelling is this mind, never staying still for a moment. That's why in Buddhism we call it the monkey mind. And many of you have heard that saying, the monkey mind. But on the last retreat which I was here, one of the retreatants, who was over, I think, from Sydney, told me a great story about the monkey mind, which I haven't told here on this retreat yet. He said that somewhere in Sri Lanka, on a Poya day, which is the moon day when everyone goes to the temple, like the one prayer in Thailand, the priest there, the monk, was giving a talk on meditation, and he started talking about the monkey mind. A mind which is always jumping from one thing to another, never staying still, never resting a moment. You're on retreat, and now you want to be off retreat at 3 o'clock this afternoon. You get off retreat, and then you want to get home. You're at home, then you want to go somewhere else. We're always on the move, never staying still, going or being here. We're always going to the next thing or somewhere else. Just like the monkeys swinging through the trees. So this priest was giving a sermon about the monkey mind. And it just so happened that a monkey from the forest was in the temple looking for something to steal and eat, and happened to hear that monk, that priest, talk about the monkey mind. And what he heard, he was not impressed with. Because this monk was really scolding the monkey mind and saying a monkey mind is a bad thing to have. And the monkey said, "What's wrong with a monkey mind? This is just, it's species stereotyping. This is not on in today's world. This is defamation. This is scolding. This is abuse. We can't stand for this." And so he got very, very upset hearing what monks say about the mind of a monkey. So he went back to his troop to complain to the head monkey. And when all the other monkeys heard about this, they were incensed. "How can these human beings say such things about a monkey mind? What makes human beings so special they can criticize us in such a way? What's wrong with the monkey mind? We demand rights for the monkey mind. You can't say this to us." And they're all jumping up and down, very angry. And that's when the leader of the troop said, "See, that's what a monkey mind is." Always jumping up and down, getting upset. And all the monkeys said, "Yeah, that's right." And they were very ashamed. And they said, "It's a terrible thing having a monkey mind. And you know, human beings abuse us for having a monkey mind. But how can we change? How can we become animals who have a mind that human beings respect?" So when a priest or a monk starts talking about a monkey mind, it's a term of praise, something which human beings aspire towards, rather than something they're trying to get rid of. And so the head of the monkeys said, "Well look, there is a way of actually training our minds to not jump about so much and be still, and it's called meditation." And all the monkeys said, "Teach us meditation, teach us meditation." So it's the first time in history the monkeys had a meditation retreat. They sat in the middle of the forest, in a nice clearing, and the head monkey was trying to teach them how to meditate. So there they sat on little piles of grass, their left paw, the right paw and their left paw, their back straight, closing their eyes and watching their breath going in and out. But being little monkeys, they couldn't last very long watching their breath. And one of them put their hand up, or their paw up, after 5 minutes and said, "Excuse me, excuse me. Don't you remember that we're supposed to go to that banana plantation to raid it for lunch? And that's only about an hour's time. Why don't we go to the banana plantation now, get the bananas, so get that out of the way so we don't have to think about it? Because I can't stop thinking about, you know, going to the plantation in an hour's time. And then once we've got all the bananas together, we won't eat it yet because it's not lunchtime. Then we can put the bananas down. Then we can go back and sit in meditation and we don't have to worry about, you know, the future, about getting the bananas." And all the monkeys said, "Great idea, yeah, yeah, we'll do that." So they all got off, all got up from their seats, and they swung off the banana plantation. They stole loads and loads of bananas, brought them all back to the clearing, put them all in a big heap. They weren't going to eat them yet. They just got it out of the way. So now they can sit in meditation without worrying about raiding the plantation. So then they sort of sat on their seats, the right paw over the left paw, back straight, heads down, watching the breath go in and out. After 3 minutes, a monkey put his paw up. "Excuse me. You know those bananas we've just stolen? Before we eat them, we've got to peel them. And I can't stop thinking about peeling those bananas. So why don't we all peel them first? And once they're all peeled, we won't eat them yet. We just put them in, we're not eating because that's lunchtime. Once they're all peeled, then we don't have to think about that. We get it out of the way. Once it's out of the way, we can sit down and meditate. Great idea, said all the monkeys. So they all got up and started peeling their bananas, all put them in a heap. No, it was a tough ask not to eat them, but they were good. They put them in the heap, and they went back to their seats, right paw of the left paw, back straight, heads down, watching their breath. Excuse me, said one of the monkeys after 2 or 3 minutes. You know, before we actually eat these bananas, we have to put them in our mouth. Why do we get that out of the way first? Because I can't stop thinking about putting this in my mouth. So all the other monkeys said, yeah, good idea, great idea. Let's get out of the way, that out of the way so we don't have to think about it. So they all got a banana each, and some monkeys got two. Stuffed them in their mouth, and then put the right banana back straight, close their eyes, and try to meditate. But of course they couldn't help chewing all those bananas. And that was the end of the hour for meditation. How many of you have packed your bags to get it out of the way? So get it out of the way so I don't have to think about it anymore. Now I can meditate. How many of you have actually put your toothbrush away or sort of got your new clothes ready for leaving this afternoon? How many of you have got it out of the way so now I can meditate? How many monkeys are on the street? That's what we mean by the monkey mind. That's a very great story because that's just so true to life. So please don't pack your bags until just the last moment. Otherwise, when you try and get things out of the way and then I'll meditate, you'll never be able to do it. But if you really realize the happiness in meditation, we say, I'll get meditation out of the way first of all, and then I'll eat. I get meditation out of the way first of all, then I'll wash the dishes. I get meditation out of the way first of all, and then I'll do all my work. Get meditation out of the way first of all. Give it priority in your life. And then when people ask, how can I meditate when I get home? How can I carry on this wonderful practice of peace and happiness? That's how you do it. Give it priority. Because whatever you develop in meditation, that you're going to make use of later on in your life. When you're old or sick, and you're like running up. So meditation, which is helping her now. Not all the work she's done. Not all the dishes she's cleaned. Not all the other stuff she's done. But your meditation. So that's your investment for the future. That's your Buddhist super fund. The super fund of peace and happiness and wisdom and kindness. So we do this because it's important to rest, to be still, to be peaceful. And don't think that it's ever wasting time. Meditation is always an investment of time. Next Tuesday I'll be teaching my masterclass at this Human Resources Conference in London. And teaching people how to make better use of your time. In business, in work, sometimes time is at a premium. And the reason why we get busy is not that we do so many things. One of my sayings I'm going to tell them is busyness is not doing many, many things, but doing too many things at the same time. You're doing one thing and you're worrying about something else. That's what busyness means. I've seen so many people who are very, very efficient and get lots done. You look at them and they're just flowing through the day. It's almost effortless. They get so much done. They're the people who do one thing at a time and do it well. They don't have to do it again. Too often we make so many mistakes. The task at hand isn't well done. We have to revisit it afterwards. We actually waste a lot of time. Because we work inefficiently. And people who have heavy schedules. One person here was telling me, and I was relating to them. Somebody was saying, that people tell me I do too much, I get so much done. And they say, you must be stressed out. But they said, no, it just flows quite easily. That's people tell me that as well. Slow down. You're doing too much. I enjoy every moment of it. But if you enjoy every moment, you're efficient, one thing at a time, in the moment, give it happiness, and life flows pretty easily, without stress, even though you get a lot done. This is what you learn in meditation, to be here, and every now and again to rest, to give it that rest time, that play time, so that when you go back to your job afterwards, you're fresh, and you don't get so tense and angry and upset about yourself, which is a common cause for some of the things which happen in workplaces and offices. If you could only give yourself a few moments of peace during the day. And one very, very skillful method which I can encourage you to do is coming from a fellow who is an executive, I think somewhere in New York, who every hour, on the hour, at his desk, in front of his computer screen, closes his eyes for 1 minute and meditates. Only 1 minute every hour he meditates. But when his boss passes him, he sees his eyes closed, you think, oh, he must be thinking about the contract. He must be thinking about the business. He must be thinking about something, because it's okay to have your eyes closed for 1 minute. And they don't know what he's doing, just watching his breath, making his mind peaceful and calm. And he says that helps him so much, keep his center throughout the day. He invests 1 minute every hour, and it's easy to take 1 minute, and no one knows what you're up to. And that way you can meditate for 1 minute every hour to center yourself, to regain your mindfulness. And he says it's a great efficient way to add a little bit of mindfulness and peace into your work day. And you always remember, every hour on the hour, peace and stillness. So afterwards, you're refreshed and centered instead of being scattered. There are such skillful ways of taking this practice into the world. And it's important you learn that. And do it now to get it out of the way so you can cope with the pressures of our modern life. You can cope with the pressures of modern families. You can cope with the pressures of modern Buddhist societies or Buddhist fellowships. There's committee members and secretaries of all these organizations here. And it's not that hard to do. So this is how we see the benefits of our meditation in our daily life. Let alone those health benefits which I was mentioning yesterday. Simply meditating and being still has enormous health benefits. I don't know how many people come to our center in Nolamara. Even last night when I gave a talk there, a couple of people came up afterwards. Doctor sent them there. They said, you know, they've got some sort of psychological problem, a health problem, and doctor sent them to our center in Perth. We should actually start charging for this, because the government pays, so they don't have to pay for it. We should have like a Medicare desk, and so people can sign afterwards and get $30 per consultation, whatever it is. But no, we would never do that. It's all done for free. And they come there because there are benefits and health. When I visited our monastery in California just over a year ago, I heard this on the grapevine. I checked it out. It's actually true. Because in the United States you don't have free medical care unless you're really, really poor, and that's only in some states, it means that everyone has to have a health fund, which you have to pay for. That's why it's quite a big impost on our monastery in California, because the Buddhist Society, their trustees, actually have to pay every monk. Every monk has to have private health cover. But, they said, when you fill out those forms for your health cover, when they assess your risk factor so they can work out the premium you have to pay, one of the questions is, do you meditate? And if you can prove that you are a meditator, you get a huge reduction in your health premium you have to pay. Because everybody knows that when you meditate, you become healthier, so you don't cost the health fund so much money. When we think about this, we should really have this retreat subsidized by the government health department, of both Australia and Singapore, because there's many people coming from Singapore, and from Malaysia, and from wherever else you come from. Because it makes you healthier. We're doing the government's job for them, so they should help us out. But it's, you get your health benefits. And you can feel that when your body really relaxes. Not only, as I said yesterday, all this power and energy goes to parts of your body, and you feel so relaxed afterwards. Just your blood pressure goes down, and your sort of your mind feels at ease, and all the stress-related problems start to heal. It's wonderful what you can do with meditation, and how these sicknesses, they tend to just ease and almost fade away. So it's great being able to get the health benefits of meditation. So we keep it going in our daily life. Whenever we're stressed out, please stop and meditate. Because I gave the talk last night at Nolamara Center, and I've been meditating for 9 days, and getting some really nice meditation here myself. It's amazing just how that creates the increase in mindfulness. Because I gave the story last night at Nolamara, which I think I've already given here, about when you meditate and your mind gets very, very still and you get lots of mindfulness energy coming up, even the food tastes more delicious. And I told the story about the first meditation retreat I did in boarding houses in Cambridge, and how I was just so afraid that the food would be tasteless because it's boarding house food, and how, to my surprise, the boarding house food was actually very delicious. I realized it's not because of the cooking, because my mindfulness has increased and my taste buds were more sensitive. But as I was telling that story, I just, because I've been meditating for such, for the last 9 days, very, very deeply, I just even remembered the street name, Bateman Street in Cambridge, where those boarding houses were. I haven't thought about that for about 30 years. And this is just common. Whenever you get really still in meditation, it's amazing what you can bring up from the past, how much you can remember. When you get obviously very, very still and blissed out just after meditation, that's when you can even recall your past lives. But little details like that, which I hadn't thought of for such a long time, just when I started telling that story, were all coming back to me. Which is actually one of the other great benefits of meditating. Your memory just increases enormously. And that's such a wonderful thing to have. Sometimes people ask me, Ajahn Brahm, you've got such a great memory, all those jokes you keep in mind. How can you do that? And I say, it's meditation. That's how you can remember so many jokes. But it's not just remembering jokes that you meditate for. It's also whatever else you have to do in your life. If you have to read a report for work, if you have to read a book, for, the instruction manual. How many times do people need to read that before the message goes in? Sometimes we have to read it again and again and again, and it never goes in. That's why we waste so much time. But when you really train your mind, and you get this very still mind, and the memory just increases enormously. You can read these things once or twice, and you remember. Imagine how much time you can save that way. And also, when you want to repeat something. When I give talks, I'm listening to the talk as I give it. I noticed last night just how easy that talk was to deliver at Nolamara Center. Where usually I'm quite tired after people pepper me with questions and their problems before the talk. And just how easy it was to flow, simply because the mind was energized with mindfulness. So much goes easily when you have that still and powerful mind. You become efficient and a high achiever. I'm saying that because you're not going to stay in this retreat. You're going to go back to work soon. And you may be terrified of having to go back to work. At least that's what you sounded like this morning when I mentioned it. But no need to be terrified, because if you've done your meditation properly, if you develop strong mindfulness, get the idea of how to rest, the importance and value of stillness, and how it increases your memory, how it makes you healthier and happier, you understand, just you'll be going back to work a changed product. People will notice there's something different about you. I hope so anyway. It usually happens that way. You become more peaceful, be able to do more with less stress. What a wonderful thing that is. So you do benefit when you go out into that world and go to your work. You're an easier person to live with. But even more than that, because many of you are Buddhists, not all people who come on retreats are Buddhists. The last retreat we had a Muslim come on this retreat. But because you are all Buddhists, I think, or mostly Buddhists, that when you come on this retreat, all those teachings which you hear about what Buddhism teaches, and what the Buddha did, and what the Eightfold Path is, and the Four Noble Truths are, blah, blah, blah. You hear that so often, you read about it in the books. But it's only in a retreat such as this, you actually visit what all those stories are talking about. It's like you have these guidebooks of what it's like, say, in France. And you may have the video of Paris. You may have sort of a Discovery Channel on the south of France. And now you finally go there. And you experience what they were talking about. You feel, rather than just see it on a TV screen. And that's a powerful, powerful, powerful message. When you experience a little bit of letting go. When you're sitting there and you've been struggling and striving with your meditation all week or maybe for years. And suddenly you press a little button called the let go button. And just allow things to be. You stop struggling. And you experience just how peaceful and how easy it is. Maybe just for one sitting. But that sitting was so, so important. Because now you've had some understanding about what the Buddha meant. You've tasted something rather than just reading about it. And maybe you go deeper. Deeper and go into, say, Nimitta realms. And all these things which you read about why these monks and these nuns, lay people also, can really get so much happiness. Sitting down cross-legged for hours. How can that be interesting? You have the most fascinating experience of your life. You can see just how the mind can open up and awaken. And you go out and you can enjoy that garden so much. Maybe in 2 or 3 days' time when you go home or go back to your countries, you may find a garden which has been more manicured than this, better watered, have professional gardeners rather than the volunteers in this garden. It won't be as beautiful, simply because your mind is not as receptive as it is here on this retreat. You're learning where beauty lies. Didn't Shakespeare say, beauty is in the eye of the beholder? He was almost right. Beauty is in the mind of the beholder. It's not out there in the world, it's in you. When you're peaceful, when you're still, everything becomes so beautiful. That's why I told the people in Nolamara last night. I said, when you do a little bit of meditation and you go home, your old 50-year-old wife looks much more beautiful than you ever thought. You might think that she's had a makeover, but no, you, your mind has had a makeover, not her. And it's true, that's what happens. Everything gets more beautiful and more fun. And isn't that wonderful to spread more fun and joy as well? Sure, it's great to be compassionate and kind. The big question is, how can we become compassionate? Not should we. And may all religions, all people, they try to do the best, but they usually screw up. And they usually make more problems than when they started. So it's wonderful to know how to be compassionate. And what is compassion anyway, but how to spread peace and happiness in this world? Now you know how to do it. By coming on a meditation retreat like this, it's the most compassionate and kind thing you've ever done for other people in years. Number one, you give them 9 days of freedom from you. And number two, when you go back there, you're a much kinder, easier person to live with. Remember, other people have got to put up with you. It's not that you have to put up with other people. You're one of those people which other people have to put up with. So when you're more kind and peaceful and fun-loving, and you're much nicer to be around, more helpful, and also far more sensitive. Just like you're sensitive to the grass, so you tread very softly. If you've been out there in the grass and you just don't want to damage it sometimes, when you get into deep meditation, you think, this little grass here, it's got a life itself, I better not tread too heavily on it. You get so sensitive to other beings and what's around you. And with that sensitivity, you can actually create so much happiness and peace in the world around you. You don't just go into your office or through the world or not even driving your car like the proverbial bull for the china shop. Just breaking things as you charge through your life, chasing your own agendas. You're more sensitive to the other people around you. You bruise less people. That's why we get sensitive. And it's a wonderful thing to be able to do that, because how many people have bruised you? They've been following their goals and their so-called duties and responsibilities, and sometimes you've been in the way and you've got bruised and injured. We do the same to others. So it's great to have that sensitivity, which you do get from this meditation. And then you can be compassionate. You are able to be kind. Before, you wanted to be kind. You tried to be kind, and you usually stuffed up. But now you know how to be kind. It becomes a natural emanation of a peaceful person. So this is what happens from the meditation. Not only do you get peaceful and healthy, you learn about compassion. How to be compassionate. And the best thing of all is you also learn just about what real wisdom is. The insight and understanding which makes life so clear, and at last you've got the instructions. So much of life is searching for the instruction manual when things go wrong and you can't find where someone put it. Where is this manual? I'm hurting. Why? Where's the manual? What am I supposed to do next? I'm suffering. I can't get a relationship. I feel lonely. I feel depressed. I feel frustrated. Where's the manual? And you're finding that instruction manual at last. You understand how it all works. Because you're sensitive and you get still and your mindfulness increases. That's why you get this incredible insights. And many of you had heaps of insights on this retreat into your life, into your relationships, how to deal with your husband, your wife, your kids, your parents, how to do a little bit more letting go, a little bit more forgiveness, a little bit more acceptance and compassion, because that's what you've learned for yourself. Never mind me, I'm a completely hopeless meditator. I spent 9 days sleeping, trying the Ananda method of enlightenment. Never mind, because this is, you do many retreats, and every retreat gets a little bit better every time. It's a gradual path, but you see the improvement. And that makes it all worthwhile. Now the monks who have been chaperoning me during the interviews, one of them told me that it's wonderful actually going to these interviews, because they've actually seen, they've just been sitting back while I've been doing the talking. They've seen, when you come, 1, 2, 3, 4 times, some of you, they see an improvement every time. They see that something happens. And they see that because they're sitting back looking objectively. So there is an improvement. It's a gradual improvement. You can't expect miracle things to happen, but every retreat there's always one or two people get miracle things happen. And it's their turn. Maybe next retreat it's your turn. Retreat afterwards, maybe someone else's turn. It gets better and better as you get more and more insights. And the insights free you to allow you to go deeper. It's always what we call the dance of insight and peace. The more insight, the easier it is to be at peace. The more peaceful you are, the more insights come flooding. And the insight and peace, the samatha vipassana, always dance together as a pair, inseparable. Because it's the insight gets rid of the obstacles so you can be peaceful. And the peace allows you to see deeper. And this is what happens. You get more insights, more experience of peace, more insights, more experience of peace. And it builds and builds and builds until you really get to know about your body and you really get to know about your mind. And the deepest truths of this universe, what we call the Dharma, the stuff which makes you enlightened, you come to that gradually. It's the insight that makes you more peaceful. The peace gives you more insights. Until you get so peaceful, you get the great insights. And the great insights lead to enormous peace. The peace of a Buddha. So there's a gradual path which leads not on and on, but in and in and in. Deeper and deeper into the peaceful silence of the mind. Deeper and deeper into that thousand petal lotus. So you can see what's at the heart of it all. What's in the middle of all this? What makes this whole universe run? You go into that and see it for yourselves. That's why Buddhism is a path which you have to experience, each person for itself. Pachatan Wejitabo Vinyuhi. And this is how you do it. So this retreat is not the end of your practice. It's part of your journey towards enlightenment. And these retreats, you make heaps and heaps and heaps of progress. And some of you think, well, sort of progress, but no paycheck yet. Be careful, because sometimes the paycheck comes a couple of days after the retreat finishes. You know why? It's because while the retreat is on, you're always expecting the paycheck. And sometimes it happens you go home, and tonight you go into your bed and you're not expecting anything at all, and then something hits you. It's amazing just how many people get these incredible deep insights, not on the retreat but a couple of days afterwards. Why? It's because they've put all of the work in, all the causes are in place, and it's just that expectation is stopping it. And at home you don't expect anything. I shouldn't have said this, because now you probably expect it at home. And then it comes. So, I really do hope, I don't hope, I know, that this retreat has been a very powerful experience in your lives. If you don't realize it, it's true, nevertheless. And it gives you lots of insights and peace and happiness, enhancing the joy of your life. Enhancing the compassion, the health, and the great insights and depth of understanding of this amazing path we call the Dhamma. So there's still a few hours to go. And so never waste anything in life. Make use of this. But not with striving. Not with expectations. Not with saying, right, 2 hours to go, this is it, I'm going to sit here, I'm not going to move till lunch. Don't do stupid things like that. Put your effort into letting go, into being at peace, into being kind, to being with this moment. Be kind to every moment. Make peace, and make peace, and make peace. That is the training. Not getting things, but allowing peace to grow. So that's the final formal talk of this retreat. Are there any questions? It's amazing. Any comments or questions about that talk? Okay. We can meditate now until 11 o'clock, till lunchtime. You can sit, you can walk, you can go back to your room if you wish. And just enjoy the momentum. At 11 o'clock we have our lunch. And afterwards, you can meditate. If you have to pack, no packing before lunch. After lunch, well, okay, you've got 1 or 2 hours, but not before. Don't be like that monkey. We've got to peel those bananas before we eat them, so we might as well do it now. And if you have packed your bags already, unpack them. As a penance. Ha ha ha. So you're not like a monkey. And enjoy the morning. And then afterwards, after lunch, you can pack if you want. Meditate. Just, you can carry on meditating or walk if you want. You can talk with each other after lunch. But gee, you're going to be talking tomorrow and the day after. And if you really want to be still and silent, just enjoy it to the max. Get your money's worth. And don't start talking until 3 o'clock. And at 2 o'clock, please everyone come in here and we give a final meditation together, which ends with a metta meditation. And then a blessing. And that ends the retreat. So it's a beautiful way of putting an end to something wonderful. So off you go, meditate and have fun.